When we start our education in anesthesia, induction of general anesthesia can be quite overwhelming. All of these drugs, some new and unfamiliar, and intubating, something we've probably seen but never from the point of view of the person doing it. As we progress, it starts to become second nature and doesn't seem like as big of a deal. With as much as we are learning in such a short amount of time, it's easy to forget why we are doing the things we are doing during induction. So let's review some of the common medication practices and why we follow them. First up, in pre-op, we frequently give midazolam, a benzodiazepine, for both its anxiolysis and amnesia properties. I don't think this is a drug we should just skip without reason. Patients appreciate the anxiolysis and amnesia effects. Think about how many patients tell you as you're wheeling them to the OR, "I don't remember this part from last time." It's because of the midazolam, and they are almost always thankful that they can't recall that part. You can justify giving almost every adult patient 2 mg of midazolam. For pediatric patients, 0.5 mg per kilogram PO, or 0.05 to 0.1 mg per kilogram IV are appropriate. We usually don't have the luxury of an IV in a pediatric patient, though. There are varying views on whether or not to give this to elderly patients. Elderly is usually considered in literature to be over age 65. Some providers you will find use a hard cutoff of 70, and they don't give it to anyone over age 70. My question for them, if my birthday is today and I just turned 70, I can't get midazolam, but yesterday I could have? Obviously this is a bit extreme. The concern with midazolam is that it can cause postoperative cognitive delay. I tried to find literature to give more objective direction, but there really isn't anything with a direct, straightforward answer for anesthesia. Currently, I reduce my dose with increasing age. I take into account their current level of anxiety, cognitive function, and whether they are currently taking any benzodiazepines. Now that you have made your choice on the use of midazolam, you take the patient from the pre-op bay and into the OR. You connect your patient to the standard monitors. The next drug that you should be considering is lidocaine. Lidocaine is an amide local anesthetic. Like all local anesthetics, it is a sodium channel blocker. Lidocaine specifically is a class 1B antiarrhythmic. I don't know that knowing the specific class of antiarrhythmic is important, but you should know that it is an antiarrhythmic. It elevates the threshold for depolarization, which essentially makes it harder for ectopic pacemakers to depolarize before the SA node. This inhibits the recurrence of dysrhythmias. I had a patient once that went into junctional rhythm. I gave them lidocaine, and they converted back to sinus and stayed there. However, we don't routinely give lidocaine any anesthesia for dysrhythmias. Why do we give it? A common answer is to prevent the burn of propofol. It can help with the propofol burn, but you only need about 40 mg for that purpose. So why do we give more than that? IV lidocaine can control the tracheobronchial reflex induced by local stimulation. For our purpose, that would be laryngoscopy. However, it also works great when you're going to do a MAC for a TEE or EGD. In addition, administration of IV lidocaine at 1.5 to 2 mg per kilogram 2 to 3 minutes before laryngoscopy may blunt a rise in heart rate, systolic blood pressure, mean arterial blood pressure, and catecholamine levels associated with intubation and extubation. I think it is important to note that the dose found in literature is 1.5 to 2 mg per kilogram, not just a flat 100 mg for everyone. I usually give 1.5 mg per kilogram based on adjusted body weight where applicable. And keep in mind that the maximum dose of lidocaine is 4.5 mg per kilogram plain or 300 mg, whichever is less. You'll give your lidocaine dose early because it needs a couple of minutes to work. Next, you will likely be reaching for fentanyl, or other opioids will work as well, but their timing needs to be adjusted. Why do we give fentanyl, an opioid mu receptor agonist? Frequently students will say because of pain, but does laryngoscopy hurt? If you try to put your finger down your throat, it is quite uncomfortable, but it does not hurt. As long as you are doing your DL right, you should not be causing a lot of pain. However, when you put something in your throat, there will be a sympathetic discharge. Your body starts to freak out about what's going on. We give opioids to blunt the sympathetic response. I find this strange, giving an opioid to blunt sympathetic, but it works, and we have seemingly always done it this way. The usual accepted dose is 1 microgram per kilogram of fentanyl 1 to 2 minutes prior to induction. You can also use remifentanil. I usually use 1 mic per kilo about a minute before induction. Hydromorphone is also a good choice. I usually give the dose in pre-op as we are rolling out of the pre-op bay because it takes about 10 minutes for peak effect. For hydromorphone dosing, I usually keep in mind that 1 milligram is approximately equal to 70 micrograms of fentanyl, and dose accordingly, usually around 1 milligram. Now if you find yourself doing a case that doesn't have much postoperative pain, or you are trying to provide an opioid-free anesthetic, this might lead you to the question, why are we using opioids to blunt a sympathetic response? Don't we have something to block the sympathetic receptors? The answer is we do, esmolol, a quick-acting, short-duration, beta-1 selective antagonist. Dosing is a little harder to recommend. Most of the studies were done with comparing 2 mg per kilogram of esmolol to 2 micrograms per kilogram of fentanyl. If you're giving lidocaine, that would reduce the dose needed. If you are having to mask with gas while waiting for a paralytic to take effect, that would reduce the dose needed. My usual approach is to give 20 to 30 milligrams, let it flush in, and then DL. Some providers prefer to wait to give it until the patient starts to show signs of sympathetic response, because everything else we have given, lidocaine, propofol, and gas, is often enough to blunt sufficiently. Now we've gotten a set of vitals, pre-oxygenated, our patient is positioned optimally, and our pre-induction medications are given. For induction, we almost exclusively use propofol. Etomidate is a good option for induction when hemodynamic stability is extremely important, such as patients with aortic stenosis. The usual dose is 0.2 to 0.4 milligrams per kilogram. The major drawback to etomidate is that it causes adrenal cortical suppression, which can be fatal for septic patients who are already steroid depleted and have a very limited stress response. Adrenal cortical suppression causes a decrease in cortisol, and as you may recall, cortisol is required for beta receptors in the heart and for the vasculature to respond to catecholamines. Ketamine is a great choice for trauma and septic patients where hemodynamic control is vital without inhibiting steroid production. It's a safer choice than etomidate in septic patients. The dosing of ketamine for anesthesia induction varies widely. A great thing about ketamine is that you can give it IM as well, unlike our other induction drugs. For IV administration, it is 1 to 4.5 milligrams per kilogram, while IM is 6.5 to 13 milligrams per kilogram. Pre-medicating with midazolam can cut that dose in half. There are a lot of great things about ketamine, but they are beyond this discussion. With propofol being used so frequently, you probably have a decent grasp on its use and dosing. Just a quick review though. It is essentially dosed to effect, meaning give it until you achieve the response you are looking for. This is usually 1 to 2.5 milligrams per kilogram. I prefer to start with smaller doses and give more as needed. You can always give more, but you can't take it back. In elderly patients, keep in mind that it takes a little longer for the drug to circulate. Be patient. If you give a small dose and give it an extra 30 seconds to circulate, you will likely be surprised by how little you need. One other thing of note with propofol, be careful with the generic versions. Diprovan is the name brand. If your vial does not say Diprovan, look at the label. Many of the generic formulations have sodium metabisulfite as a preservative. This compound can cause bronchospasms in asthmatics. I have not personally seen it happen, though I have not used much generic propofol, but just know that it is a possibility. The last thing to address is muscle relaxant. We have the patient asleep. Now is the time to paralyze them if you want to. Paralysis is helpful in attaining ideal intubating conditions, but it is not required as it seems we are frequently led to believe. You can induce and intubate a patient without paralytic. You will likely find that we almost never paralyze children before intubation, and they tend to be more difficult to intubate in my opinion. There are a lot of procedures where paralysis is preferred and sometimes required. You will almost always paralyze an adult patient prior to intubation, but with which drug? Succinylcholine is useful for potentially difficult airways, and also when you just want paralysis for intubation, but is not required throughout the case. Keep in mind that it can cause a potassium release. Be mindful of potassium levels and do not use it in debilitated or burn patients. They have an increase in extrajunctional receptors and can have significant potassium release. Rocuronium is the most commonly used non-depolarizing muscle relaxant. It can be used for RSI with higher doses, but with increased duration. Rocuronium has an increased terminal half-life in renal failure patients, probably because of its partial renal elimination. But this translates into only slight prolongation of the block. In hepatic disease, the slower uptake and elimination of rocuronium by the liver tends to prolong the duration of action of the drug, but this is compensated to some extent by the larger volume distribution. Becuronium is an alternative to rocuronium. It has slower onset, but has similar duration to rocuronium. Some providers feel that its effects and duration are more predictable than rocuronium. Its usual dose is 0.08 to 0.1 mg per kilogram. It is sometimes preferred in CABG because rocuronium has shown some slight hemodynamic changes in this patient population. Renal and liver disease can prolong the duration of both becuronium and rocuronium. In these cases, cisatricurium is a viable alternative. It undergoes Hoffman elimination, an enzymatic process that is independent of the kidneys and liver. Usual dosing of cisatricurium is 0.1 to 0.2 mg per kilogram. Though it undergoes Hoffman elimination, it does need to be reversed. Sugammadex works on becuronium and rocuronium, but you will have to use neostigmine and glycopyrrolate to reverse cisatricurium. I hope this helps you understand a little better why we do what we do on and around induction.